each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And today, as I'm sure all of you know, is the 16th anniversary of the 9/11 terrorist attacks on our country, the largest loss of life ever on domestic soil in an act of war against our country. Very, very sad day that has lasting ramifications for all of us. I was listening to NPR on my way in, and really a fascinating interview today with a man who helped to raise money for the medical expenses of those who were first responders to the 9/11 attacks. As some of you may be aware, many of those people who were the first to respond, to assist and to provide aid, wound up with long-lasting and irreversible health challenges, cancer, autoimmune diseases. Many of them, of course, suffered, you know, kind of catastrophic injuries themselves, injured by falling debris, et cetera, et cetera. And the man who has been raising money for their medical expenses to help them meet the ones not covered by their insurance says he's been to 187 funerals of first responders who have since died in those 16 years since the 9/11 attacks. And so, you know, it really is important to continue to pray for those who were impacted not only on that day, but who, you know, day in and day out since that happened, live with the 9/11 attack at every moment. I have a friend who lost her brother today. And so please do keep in your thoughts and your prayers everyone who was impacted by that terrible event. So we're going to start today. I've been asked to share with you, those of you who are in the Chicago area listening, in the northwest suburbs in particular, an event that's going to be happening this Wednesday to honor the lives of two young girls, two babies who were killed or left to die, abandoned, and for whom a proper funeral has not been said yet. But through the efforts of a very good woman named Susan Walker, there are going to be funerals, a double funeral for these two baby girls. Baby Miriam, who was a child who was dropped from an eighth-floor window, apartment window in Chicago, and also baby Aria Michaela, who was simply found dead in a shed in Dalton, Illinois. So we're going to be commending these two little girls to God's mercy. We're going to be having a proper funeral for them at St. Mary's Parish in Buffalo Grove, Illinois, at 10 a.m. That's St. Mary's Parish in Buffalo Grove at 10 a.m. So if you can join in, everyone is welcome to come and to pray with us for these girls, for the people who were the first responders. We just talked a little bit about first responders at 9/11. So the first responders to the deaths of these two children, we're going to be praying for them and also for the families. And we pray that, you know, the short lives of these children will have had some impact, if not here, certainly in eternity. So again, 10 a.m. Wednesday morning at St. Mary's Parish in Buffalo Grove, Illinois. For those of you who are in the northwest suburbs, you would be more than welcome. The funeral mass is open to the public. So Now, my guest today is a longtime heroine of mine, because this is a woman who was doing things in a cause near and dear to my heart long before many other people took the initiative to get involved. And that cause, of course, is the pro-life movement. And joining me today in the studio is Bonnie Quirk, who is the executive director of Lake County Right to Life. Welcome, Bonnie.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. It certainly is an auspicious day, isn't it?
It is. It's a sad day. I was speaking a little bit about that in my introduction. And, you know, it's a day, Bonnie, that I think for many of us, I've actually been trying to avoid some of the Facebook images I've been seeing today and some of the videos people are posting, because, it brings you right back to that moment, doesn't it?
It certainly does. You know, I think September 11th, 5 years ago, it was Benghazi.
Mm-hmm. Right, of course.
And before that, Malta and Venice. And we have a long history with 9/11. Kind of in a way, don't you think, Mary, ties to the pro-life movement?
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that, because one of the things I did watch this morning, and I try to make a point of watching this every year, is the memorial in New York, where they have the family of the people who died in the Twin Towers, or the first responders, reading the names. And they read each and every single name. And then when the particular person reading it gets to his or her family member name, they pause and make a brief statement, or tell them they're still praying for them and they miss them still, you know, 16 years later. And you just listen, first of all, to the variety of the names, you know, Gonzalez and O'Sullivan and Ortiz, and, you know, the different ethnic and religious and racial backgrounds, all those people lost on that day, but that each and every one of those human beings was special and important to somebody, right? Every person has a unique role in our world. God creates them. You know, there's no other, you know, Oscar Gonzalez was one of the names. I don't know why I remember it, but, you know, there's no other him now on this earth. Every single one of us is irrepeatable, right? So there'll never be another person, you know, who was lost on that day. That person's gone forever. And this is something, Bonnie, of course, you very early on in the pro-life movement, and me, you know, a little bit later, it is a point you try to make, you know, that at the moment of conception, you have a genetically irrepeatable and irreplaceable person. There will never be another person like that.
Never, never. And that is really the sanctity of life ethic, mm-hmm. which drives us to do what we're doing.
Well, now tell me, I want you to kind of go back to the beginning, because, again, you've been doing this way, way longer than I ever have. How did you first get involved? Do you even remember at this point?
It's in the past. You know, it's interesting. I'm a cradle Catholic, and I knew that different states were legalizing abortion. New York had done it, Oregon, different states, and it was a matter of time. And in fact, Illinois was pondering doing it. And so when the Supreme Court decision came down, I actually was working in the city.
And you're a nurse by training.
I am.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I'm one of those who trained first responders. I trained the original paramedic program,
wow.
both in Chicago and in Lake County.
Oh, my goodness.
So I know many of the first responders. But back to the life movement. The decision came down, and I thought, oh, my goodness, it'll be over in a year.
Mm-hmm.
We will.
No one will put up with this kind of extremity, you know, extremities in the law.
I thought the American public, every Christian denomination, the bishops, all rise, and our Catholic bishops did, and the Catholic laity certainly did.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be finished in a year. Well, we're 43 plus years
later, right?
Later, and I thought, really, everybody has to be, everybody who professes a belief has to be in the pro-life movement.
Mm-hmm.
What else could you do?
Right.
You couldn't stand by.
No. Well, I think, you know, there was just so many lies surrounding, you know, Roe and its companion case, Doe versus Bolton, when it was decided. You know, our mutual friend, Clark Forsyth, of course, wrote a book detailing very, very explicitly. He went back and listened to every single minute of the oral arguments in the Roe and Doe cases and all of the cases leading up to that. So he's really documented that very thoroughly, like a good legal historian would. But when you realize, like, I think of Bernard Nathanson, who was the co-founder of NARAL, the National Abortion Rights Action League, who ran New York City's largest abortion clinic, later became pro-life, as you know, and you and I both had the privilege of meeting him. But he, you know, him saying, listen, during those congressional hearings that were simultaneously going on to the court decision, we made up numbers. We made them up. We knew that there weren't that many maternal deaths from abortion every year. We knew, you know, that we were giving a deinflated, if you will, statistical basis for how many abortions would happen. We knew all that. But, you know, we thought we were doing the right thing because we really thought that, you know, what we had in mind in terms of expanding the United States abortion law was just and right and would help women.
And look at his life. He had a conversion, a profound atheist, a real believer in what he was doing when he was doing it, and in fact aborted his own child.
Right, right. He performed an abortion on his girlfriend when she was pregnant with his child. But what a testament, though, to God's mercy.
Absolutely.
God's patience. I mean, he often spoke of that and said, you know, there are times when I look in the mirror and it's hard for me to even look at myself knowing what I did, but then I remember God's mercy. And
profound forgiveness.
Yes.
And that's something I think on this day of 9/11, forgiveness is a big part of what we should be thinking about.
Right, right, right.
That
right.
God's mercy and forgiveness is there for the asking.
For anyone.
For anyone
who asks
and
for it.
For any reason. There's nothing anybody could do that God's mercy and forgiveness can't reach them.
Yeah, can't reach. That's a very beautiful thing, to point out, Bonnie, because I often think of something else that Bernard Nathanson said, which was it was not, you know, so much the arguments the pro-life community was making, he said, but it was the people who loved me. It was the people in the pro-life movement who would lovingly engage me in debate and conversation. He said, I knew they were interested in me as a person. They cared about me. And he said that's really what cracked what he called his hard shell of atheism. Mm-hmm. And he became pro-life from a scientific perspective because he did an abortion while he was filming it with some in utero cameras that then became technology that then became available. And after he saw what he was doing, he stopped. He never did another one. So he became, pro-life from a scientific perspective first and became Catholic many years later. You know, it took a long time for him to accept that God would forgive him for everything, that there was a God who could be that generous with his love and his mercy. So that was very beautiful.
And I think it points out a really important fact that God will reach you where you're at.
Right.
And never stop chasing you.
Yeah.
Never stop chasing you.
So Bonnie, God must have chased you down to get you involved in such a movement because I know, you know, back in 1973, as you said, I think there was some initial shock, but first of all, I think, you know, as Clark Forsythe, the legal scholar I mentioned a few minutes ago in his book, Abuse of Discretion, which is the legal story behind Roe versus Wade, he points out even now today, most people don't know what Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton held. I was in sort of an online Facebook discussion with a couple of people, one a lawyer, and so I was kind of surprised he was so ignorant about the law that he kept telling me, no, there's a lot of really firm restrictions in place, and you can't have an abortion after 12 weeks. And so I just Googled, you know, I think it's a website called abortionclinics.com, mm-hmm. and it's run by the late-term abortion clinics. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you better report these clinics because they're all advertising, you know, 26-plus week abortions at a clinic, not in a hospital, freestanding clinics that are doing them for any reason. So you better turn these folks in because they apparently didn't get your legal memo that it's not legal. But why don't you speak a little bit about that and then about how you got involved?
Sure, sure. I also would refer him to the federal bill, which is a 20-week ban on abortion, if indeed that's 5 months. They all ought to be turned in, too.
Mm-hmm, right.
So how did I get involved? Well, Cradle Catholic, absolutely committed to knowing that life begins at conception, knowing that God calls even the most weak and otherwise not gifted people to a cause. We met in a park, actually. Well, when we founded, I co-founded Lake County Ride to Life.
Okay.
We met in a park, and we thought, oh, my goodness, this will be over in a year. And,
yes,
in fact, we had one of the founding mothers from La Leche League who lived in Libertyville,
right,
where I live.
Right.
Who, Mary Ann Cahill.
Okay.
Who was part of that group. And it was funny because her daughter was engaged to a lawyer.
Hmm.
And he said, well, we should incorporate you. And we all said, oh, we don't need it. This battle will be over in a year. We're happy to meet in the park or in the basement of somebody's home. This will be over in a year. He goes, I need the practice.
Hmm.
And so we were incorporated, Lake County Ride to Life, in 1974. And we've been viable ever since.
Wow. Well,
yeah.
When we come back from our break, Bonnie, we're going to hear a little bit more about your journey through, 43 years of working so assiduously for unborn children and their moms, and a little bit about what you are up to at Lake County Right to Life. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change here on AM 750 WNDZ.
First, it was Hurricane Harvey, devastating the people of Texas, who are now trying to rebuild their lives. Then, Florida was hit with Hurricane Irma, leaving destruction in its wake. The people of these states will need our help for many months or even years to come. How can you help? The first thing to do is to pray for our brothers and sisters who have suffered during these storms. Then, make a donation to Catholic Charities USA Hurricane Relief, where 100% of your donations will go to help with the needs of life, healthcare, and to rebuild their communities. Visit CatholicCharities.org. That's CatholicCharities.org, where you can donate online, by phone, or text. Thank you.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing. At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And I have the great privilege of being joined today by a longtime friend and mentor for me, Bonnie Quirk, who is a nurse and who is also the executive director of Lake County Right to Life. And she was just telling me about how, as many things in the pro-life movement, of those of you who are aware of it, generally started by women. That always makes me laugh, like this impression that some people have of the pro-life movement, that it's men telling women what to do with their bodies. And I thought, you have never been to a pro-life meeting, sir, in your entire life, if that is what you think about the pro-life movement, because 90% of it, I mean, my husband always feels so left out of place when I drag him to any of these things, because it's always really been a very, very bi-woman and for-woman movement. In fact, the genesis of the laws that restricted and prohibited abortion in our country really were the founding feminists in our country, right? Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony and Alice Paul, who wrote the First Equal Rights Amendment. Women back in the late 1800s wanted to see abortion banned because they saw it as a way by which men took advantage of women, by which men felt themselves entitled to use and then abandon women and their children. They had a great respect for the vulnerable, particularly children. So it was women who led the charge to, you know, make abortion illegal in this country in the first place. And now it's been women in the forefront of trying to reverse Roe and Doe in the second place. So, Bonnie, tell us, so you're meeting in a park in somewhere and up in the northwest suburb in Zion, Illinois, which was probably three farms back in those days, right?
It was. We incorporated, and we incorporated as a 501c4, which allowed us to do a little bit of lobbying in terms of legislation. And then we have an internal, what we would call a C3, which is an educational tax-exempt arm.
Okay.
So we were both.
Okay.
And we really thought at the beginning, and I still believe this, prayer, of course, is first, but we have to change the law because so many people believe what is legal must be right.
Right.
And we know that's not true in many cases.
Well, that was something Martin Luther King was fond of saying, right? Like, the law can't make you love my people, but it should can keep you from lynching them. And so he always felt as well that the morality often was tied up with what people knew to be legal.
Absolutely. And then I think as the movement developed its own, you know, God has been with this movement from the very beginning because left to our own devices, we probably would have failed from the beginning.
Right, right.
He opens doors from legislation to education and to the jewel in the crown of the pro-life movement, which are the crisis centers or medical
Help
centers.
The pregnancy
help
centers.
They are the jewel in the crown of the pro-life movement.
They sure are, and they really do. That's another thing. In addition to sometimes hearing this statement that, you know, the pro-life movement is a bunch of men, you also hear the equally false statement that pro-lifers really only care about babies up until the moment that they're born. And we don't really care about them afterwards. And we're really pro-birth. We're not pro-life. You know, there's that meme with Sister Joan Chisitter that makes the rounds on Facebook and Twitter every now and again. And boy, nothing could be further from the truth. You know, I have the great privilege of serving on the board of Aid for Women, which is a pregnancy resource center in downtown Chicago. We run two maternity homes where we have numerous women who live with us well past the time of the babies being born. But we really, you know, our goal is to change women's lives one at a time and to give them the education that they need and the structure that they need and the foundation that they need to move out of our homes into their own apartments and to be financially stable and to be independent and to be self-sufficient. So we give them all those skills. And, you know, I don't see anyone in the pro-choice movement, as much as they talk about choices, supporting any of those other choices.
No, we don't see that. It's kind of funny. We would bring up Aid for Women, which is one of my favorite crisis centers, by the way. In the early days of Lake County Right to Life, my board split in half, and we split our assets, and half of them went to Aid for Women.
That's wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so it continues. There are, you know, no matter where you are in the pro-life movement, there is a place that God has for you.
Oh, right. And that's, you know, that's what I love about the pro-life movement is there's room for everybody. And you don't have to give, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week in order to be part of the pro-life movement. And I often say this if I'm doing, you know, training for particularly older people who don't feel like, gosh, I really don't know a lot about the law or about public policy, and I'm really afraid to, you know, you don't have to be an expert to do something pro-life, right? Like at Aid for Women, we have phone counselors. And so sometimes, you know, when we have a pregnant mom who's not living in one of our maternity homes, but she doesn't like really have anybody to talk to, right? Like, I mean, you probably remember back in the days when you were pregnant, you could call your mom or call your mother-in-law or maybe call an older sister or a cousin and say, gosh, this is what I'm feeling today. Is that normal? And blah, you know, a lot of these young girls are very isolated and they don't have anybody to talk to. But so we can have a mom, an experienced mom, say, oh, you know, that's really normal. You know, go take a 10-minute nap, and that feeling's going to pass. And if it doesn't, then, yeah, let's call the doctor together. I'll help you do that. They just need a friend. They need, like, an older sister sort of figure, or a maternal kind of figure to guide them through the pregnancy, because they often don't have good support networks. So that's something, you know, a lot of people feel comfortable doing. Like, I really don't feel comfortable, you know, writing letters to the editor or this, that, and the other thing. But, boy, I can do that. And then some people, you know, really have a gift for public speaking or for writing. And, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for that now, especially with social media. And, you know, and some people have a gift for being a prayerful presence in front of abortion clinics. And so there's a woman I know at church who, God bless her, she goes Friday and Saturdays to the abortion clinic on Washington Street here in Chicago and just offers women information on alternatives. And we'll say, do you know that there's this government program and that government program, and we have this and this. Can I share that information with you before you go in? I mean, she's a mother of 6 or 7 kids herself, very nice woman. And, I mean, God bless her. That's a very special calling, too, you know, to try to be there, that last person that might, you know, try to intercede for the life of that child before the mom goes in. So Lake County Right to Life has kind of a number of different functions it fulfills, doesn't it, Bonnie? Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you guys do in the movement, kind of what your niche is?
I think probably our niche is halfway between helping with the legislative effort, educating on the legislative effort.
Locally or nationally or both?
Both.
Okay.
Both state, both local, state, and national.
Okay.
Making acquaintances with our legislators, be they pro-life or be they on the other side. Always reaching out with material, with that personal contact, with a reason to have them know us by name.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is so, so very important.
It is,
so
to have relationships important. With your legislators, yeah.
Yes.
And people get very intimidated by that for some reason. I think they think, my gosh, I couldn't talk to a congressman or a senator.
They're just like us.
Right, they're just, exactly.
They are just
yes.
like us.
What do you have, so say, for example, you know, there's a bill in Illinois, about parental notification of abortion. And I, as a mom of 3 girls, feel very strongly about it. How would you recommend, as someone who's a longtime lobbyist, Bonnie, a person even start with something like that? Should they check with your organization first to get the facts about the bill and then approach their legislature?
They certainly can. We do a position paper on bills. Anybody can... You know, people are hesitant to even call their legislator's office.
Mm-hmm.
They're intimidated by the person who answers the phone.
Right.
You know, we're doing God's work. We should not be intimidated.
Right.
Those people may be in a situation where you could change the outcome of what they're facing by simply calmly stating your position and why.
Right. And a little kindness goes a long way, right? A little kind of small talk and chit chat, I think can, you know, have a tremendous impact on the way you interact with the staff. Again, this is sort of a rule for any business that you're dealing with, but, you know, always be nice to the staff people because they are human beings as well, right? I think everybody should work in a job like that at some point in their life simply to appreciate what people like that sometimes have to put up with, you know. I think sometimes people feel like they can treat anybody the way they want to because they're, you know, checking out your groceries or they're, you know, taking your order at McDonald's. But to remember that, you know, as a pro-life community, we really do believe what we say and that every human being has innate value and dignity simply because God created them. And we're to see Christ in those people, right?
Well, your ultimate job, really, is to bring them salvation. You
right.
know, God, opening the door, God brings salvation. But he does work through his people.
Yeah.
So that kindness, that personal contact opens the door, and God does the rest. That's what we're interested in, really.
Right. Well, when we come back from our break, Bonnie, we'll continue that thought about doing your part and letting God do the rest. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the divine mercy where you can enter into the presence of Christ 24/7. Every first Saturday afternoon will be a special opportunity for healing At 4:30, bring your petitions for our Blessed Mother's intercession as we pray the Rosary. Then, at 5, we share the body of Christ in the Holy Mass, followed by a Eucharistic procession, adoration, the Divine Mercy Chaplet, and an anointing. Enter into the sacred space of St. Stanislaus Kostka and place yourself before Christ for healing. On first Saturday afternoon, starting at 4:30, find St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, 2 blocks north of Division, on Noble, just off the Kennedy in Chicago, and find peace and healing.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
In 1867, Andrew Johnson was president of the United States, and St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, was established in Chicago. Today, St. Stanislaus Kostka is celebrating serving the faithful for 150 years with a Jubilee dinner Sunday, October 22nd at 1 p.m., held at the Union League Club of Chicago at 65 West Jackson. Make your reservation before Sunday, October 8th. For complete details, to reserve and pay for your tickets online, visit ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. Celebrate the 150th anniversary of the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka by joining us for dinner at 1 p.m. at the Union League Club of Chicago, Sunday, October 22nd.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C. I am sitting in today for Father Anthony on WNDZ 750 AM. And I am joined today by Bonnie Cork, who is the Executive Director of Lake County Right to Life. You can learn more about them at www.lcrtl.org, Lake County Right to Life, lcrtl.org. And Bonnie, you have an event coming up. This is one of the reasons I wanted to have you in today, because you've got an event coming up on Saturday featuring a very well-known Dominican friar who's going to be preaching on, if there was a topic even hotter than abortion right now, that would be the topic of marriage and its redefinition and the impact that that is having on children and on marriage in general. Father Brian Milady, tell me a little bit about this event and what's going to be happening.
Sure. My board a few years ago decided that, you know, the life movement is made up of marriage and life. I mean, you can't change them.
Right.
And so we are having Father Brian Milady, and we have had him before. He's a delightful Dominican speaker, a doctor of theology, and he is speaking on marriage.
Wonderful.
And he speaks from natural law. He speaks from Augustine. He will do all of the fundamental reasons God created man and woman, and that is the marriage.
Right, right. And that marriage, that's what marriage is by definition. And when, which is why the phrase same-sex marriage is a bit of a misnomer, because you can't, marriage has to be, by definition, has to be conjugal. And two people of the same gender, two people of the same sex, cannot consummate a marriage. They're not, it's not physically possible for them to consummate a marriage. So therefore, if the way in which marriage is different from other friendships, from other shared relationships, is that it is a physically conjugal relationship with another person and with only that person. You know, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, Professor Robbie George, who is another legal scholar and an ethicist at Princeton University, put out a very good book because he could kind of see the Obergefell case coming, looming in the future, called What is Marriage? A Definition, simply from a philosophical and legal perspective, talking about what marriage is as an institution and why it is that it can't be changed. You can't redefine it, because you redefine it and it loses all of its meaning. And interestingly enough, law professor Helen Alvarez at George Mason University went back and she filed one of the briefs in the Obergefell decision as well, talking about how marriage law developed in the United States and why Frankly, the Supreme Court isn't and shouldn't be interested in your romantic entanglements. It's really not. Marriage, at the end of the day, does the state, the only reason the state got involved in legalizing marriage was to protect the children that might come about as a result of that union, and to legally tie those children to the parents who gave birth to them, the fathers who fathered them, the mothers who gave birth to them, to legally obligate those parents to care for those children. That's the only reason state ever got involved in marriage. State doesn't care about acknowledging publicly who you happen to be in love with at any given day or time, right? It's that was not the purpose of marriage laws to begin with. And so then to redefine them and to say, no, marriage can be whatever two people decide it is, Professor George argued a couple of years ago, that is going to open If you redefine marriage once and say, no, it's not a conjugal union between a man and a woman, it is rather anything two people claim it should be, right? Why do you have to stop it too? And frankly, I would argue that people in polygamous communities, polygamy has been around a heck of a lot longer than same-sex marriage has. They have just as much a right to argue, listen, if you're going to redefine it for this group, it's unjust not to. And then I just saw not less than 2 weeks ago, an article by someone who is in a polyamorous marriage, he calls it. He isn't it. So there are, it's him and another man and three women, and they consider themselves a marriage. They consider themselves a family. They are adults. They have sex with each other and in groups and everything else. And he said, you know, as a Christian community, we as a polyamorous marriage and family, we feel left out. And it's about time that we had our relationships legally sanctioned, and that the church started welcoming us as polyamorous families. So Professor George, you know, just put something very, you know, quippy on his Facebook page saying, you know what, I told you so. I said that this would happen. And so I think the way I read the Obergefell decision, and Bonnie, you chime in here, I would love to hear what you think on this and what motivated you to bring in Father Milady to speak. I don't think that you can deny them legal status and legal recognition of their unions.
I think you're absolutely right, because when we redefined marriage as a country, we redefined our culture. Yeah. We absolutely redefined our culture. We opened our culture up to every secular movement that could possibly be, and put our children in grave risk, at grave risk. And we can really, if we're honest with ourselves, we can see the results of the Supreme Court decision, just like we saw it with Roe. People thought it would only be abortion. Well, the tentacles of Roe are in everything we see today.
All right, so now we're looking at assisted suicide. And we're
absolutely.
At,
suicide, well, Jack genetic Kevorkian. Engineering.
Jack Kevorkian said himself, Roe versus Wade opened the door to euthanasia and assisted suicide, in fact, if not in law. I mean, he said that was my opening. That's all I needed.
Exactly.
So.
And Obergefell opened the door. Open Pandora's box, actually.
And you know, and I want to be clear, too. This is not to say that two people of the same sex cannot share a deep friendship, cannot love each other, you know. But it is not a condemnation of the gay community as people. It is simply saying that this is what marriage is, and the relationship you have may be many things, but it can't be a marriage because it can't be conjugal, because it cannot, you know, lead to new life. And I know sometimes people will say, well, then what about, you know, marriages of people who are past childbearing age? And what about people who are, you know, but those sort of exceptions to the rule don't undo the rule, right? The point of the fact is that they have the potential to be able to be, you know, conjugal. And in a same gender union, the potential doesn't even exist, right? So it's sort of a, you know, you have to try to take the emotion out of it, because it's an issue people feel very strongly about. And Americans are very sort of in tune to issues of justice and fairness, and they see it simply as two people being denied something that everybody else has. But that's, you know, simply that is just not the case in terms of what, you know, what's going on with marriage. So tell me, what is Father? I know Father is a really so well known in the Catholic community as such an erudite scholar. Like you mentioned, he has a doctorate in sacred theology. Where is the event taking place? What time? Do we need tickets?
Sure.
Tell me a little bit more about it.
It's at Marytown, which is located at 1600 West Park Avenue in Libertyville, Illinois.
Okay.
And that is the National Shrine of Maximilian Kolbe,
right,
who is another pro-life saint that we can get into at another time. He certainly is a saint for our day. The program Father will speak from 9 to 11. The doors will open at 8, and there is a 7 a.m. Mass or a 12 noon Mass. So Father will speak on marriage, and I am sure that the question and answer period will take in some of the concerns that people have about how to deal with the secular culture on this issue as a Catholic. What we believe, how we articulate, where we should stand strong, always in love. So, again, it's this Saturday. It's free to the public. You can call us at 847-223-7022 or go on the website and you'll see all the information. But, again, the event is free. We're honored to have Father Brian Milady come and talk for us.
Right.
He's been with us before.
So again, you know, it's a Saturday morning. It's a very convenient time. You know, come have your donut and your coffee and listen to Father. He will give you so much food for thought. And, you know, as we're talking about, you know, marriage, I was privileged to have as a guest on the show here, Bonnie, Pastor Cesar LaFleur not long ago, who is a well-known pastor in the African-American community in our far southern suburbs. And we were talking about sort of violence, the issues of violence. And, you know, he very much, if you've ever heard him talk, ties that in with, first of all, abortion. He said, you know, we in the Black community can't talk about violence in our community and not talk about abortion, because it is a force of violence, you know, against our people. But he also talked about marriage. And at this point, what the current statistical data shows is that almost 73% of all Black babies are born out of wedlock.
Right.
73% of Black babies are now born out of wedlock. I think for Hispanic children, it's close to 60%. It's hovering in that area. But when you separate children from their parents, children from their families, when marriage isn't seen as necessary for, you know, for childbirth and for child rearing, then that opens up a whole nother host of issues, right? It leads to so much societal breakdown. But we are seeing, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the research, social science research that is coming out is showing that men are rejecting marriage more than ever, that the working poor are seeing, the working class and the working poor, particularly in rural areas, are seeing marriage as something that is simply unrealistic. It's beyond their reach. And I do think that the part of marriage that we saw redefined, it further separated in people's minds, if we could possibly do that. The idea that, you know, that marriage and family and sex and children all go together. We're unconnecting all of those things at a time we really need to be reconnecting them.
We dissolve our society is what we do.
Right.
Children need to have a mother and they need to have a father.
Yeah.
Each biological species brings something to the rearing of a child that the others can't.
Right. And it's not to, right, and it's not to say, again, I just want to be perfectly clear, not to say that, you know, gay men and women don't love children and can't care for them. That is not the argument.
No,
the argument is that kids need, you know, a boy needs a mom and a dad, and a girl needs a mom and a dad. You know, I have my husband's one of five boys, but happens to live in a house with all women at this point, including the dog and the two guinea pigs. He's the only male. And, you know, he often, it's amazing the perspectives that he will have on issues of child rearing and discipline and other things in talking to my daughters than I would. You know, if it was an all-female household, and I know this is going to sound stereotypical, there'd be a lot of drama all the time. And, you know, with my husband, there's no drama, you know, and that's a little bit of that's personality. But I do also believe that's part of what John Paul II called the female genius and the male genius, that the male brings certain traits and gifts in child rearing and in discipline, and the female does. You know, there was a book that came out about 25 years ago now, gosh, David Blankenhorn's book, Fatherless America, where he makes the argument that Pastor LaFleur basically did, that a male presence in a home, even if the marriage is bad, even if there's high levels of conflict, even if they're, you know, the couple's going through a very rocky patch, the presence of that male in the house, first of all, biologically, daughters, the young girls, will get their periods later. When the father moves out of the house, for whatever reason, girls will start to menstruate earlier. Mm-hmm. And then they will, you know, often be attracted to older men because they're looking for a father figure. And the male, just the presence of the older male in the house curbs young male aggression. So that's what Pastor LaFleur was talking about in the Black community, why that gang culture becomes so attractive. So when we come back from the break, Bonnie, we'll conclude our conversation today. We'll talk a little bit more about where you think the pro-life movement's headed. You have the benefit of so much perspective, and I'd love to hear it. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change here on AM 750 WNDZ.
In 1867, Andrew Johnson was president of the United States. And St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, was established in Chicago. Today, St. Stanislaus Kostka is celebrating serving the faithful for 150 years with a Jubilee dinner Sunday, October 22nd at 1 p.m., held at the Union League Club of Chicago at 65 West Jackson. Make your reservation before Sunday, October 8th. For complete details to reserve and pay for your tickets online, visit ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. Celebrate the 150th anniversary of the historic St. Stanislaus Kostka by joining us for dinner at 1 p.m. at the Union League Club of Chicago, Sunday, October 22nd.
The Winds of Change on AM 750. WNDZ, and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Kostka is the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here. St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org, and enter into the presence of Christ.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change. And my guest this hour has been Bonnie Quirk, the Executive Director of Lake County Right to Life. Bonnie is a nurse with both a bachelor's degree and a master's degree of nursing from Loyola University in Chicago. So a longtime advocate medically, but also ethically and morally for unborn children. And Bonnie got into the pro-life movement on the ground floor, like the day after Roe versus Wade was decided, ground floor kind of thing. And so Bonnie was one of the first people I met when I began working in the pro-life movement as a young lawyer. And so she brings with her, boy, hindsight, you know, 43 years of hindsight, which I am so grateful for because, you know, it's so funny. Sometimes in the pro-life movement now, you have very young, enthusiastic people coming in and right. And they're, and God bless them, you know, they are on fire. But sometimes there's a little bit of a, like, we're here now, you people back then, you couldn't get Roe overturned, we're going to show you how to do it, right? And maybe they're right. Maybe they have ideas we never had. But Bonnie, over the last 43 years, you've seen a lot. Tell me what stands out to you in those four decades of pro-life activism as either the moment that made you the most delighted, upset, angry. I'd love to hear some perspective from you.
I think for those people who remember Henry Hyde,
mm-hmm.
And Father Lawler,
yeah.
Father Lawler always Henry Hyde, who was a congressman, probably the most pro-life congressman.
Yeah, that was
Illinois
one of the great moments. Yeah, great moments of my life was meeting Henry Hyde as a young lawyer.
Yes, and he would always say, "Everything I learned about the pro-life movement, I learned from Father," and actually the Crawfords, Hiram Crawford Sr., who walked the halls of the Illinois legislature with Henry Hyde and with Father Lawler in the early days. The movement has certainly moved forward. I think, you know, I can remember I was just meeting with another old-timer, Irene Napier from McHenry.
Yes.
And she said, "Bonnie, do you remember when we would go to an event we would have to sit by ourselves. Nobody would talk to us because we were pro-life.
Right.
And she said, and now everybody wants to talk to us because we're pro-life. Not that they always believe us, but they will at least talk to us. So I think, you know, God rewards faithfulness. And the movement has been faithful.
Yeah.
It has been faithful to its calling.
Right.
It has, like St. Paul says, many arms.
Right.
Many diversities. But we are all, I would say in the early days, we were very territorial.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not a united pro-life movement.
Right.
I see now over the last maybe 10 years, we are uniting as a movement, mm-hmm. each with our own specific role.
Right.
But we are working together, not working separately, not worried about what you're going to do versus what we're going to do.
Right.
We're working together for the cause. And I think, you know, God always rewards faithfulness.
Yeah, that's what Mother Teresa said, right? That God doesn't call us to be successful. He just wants us to be faithful.
He calls us to be faithful.
So just get up and do what you're supposed to do, right?
Yes, yes. The movement has been faithful over the years. I think the complexion of the movement is changing.
And what do you mean by that?
I see a lot of younger people coming mm-hmm. into the movement.
I feel so. Anytime I go to the March for Life in Washington now, I feel ancient. I feel absolutely ancient. I think the average age of those marchers has got to be 17 or 18 years old.
Yes, and I hope they're as committed to the movement as they are to being committed to going to Washington for a march.
Yeah, yeah.
That worries me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
As with every generation, we work things out a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see how the young people manage the movement. Just a quickie. We call January 22nd a commemoration.
Mm-hmm.
They define it as a celebration.
Hmm.
And there's a big span between commemoration and celebration.
Yeah, and perhaps they're just don't have a very extensive vocabulary.
Their,
and that could just be they're misstating it, right? Because you know, young people, I don't think, read as much as people that you and I, you know, grew up reading. So the distinctions might kind of be lost on them. But that might not be an intentional.
And they haven't been tested yet either. You know, God God works through his people, always testing faithfulness, doesn't he? I mean, I'm sure, Mary, you've had this. There have been many times we could have thrown the towel in and said,
I mean,
oh,
just,
my
it
gosh,
just seems like, not, it, you know, I remember testifying. In fact, this is when Barack Obama was a state senator and testifying in front of him when he was on the Illinois Senate Judiciary Committee. And it was on the state partial birth abortion ban, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was testifying for the bill and someone from the ACLU was testifying against it. And, you know, the woman from the ACLU, you know, she could sit there and read the phone book. And all of a sudden, oh, you're wonderful, not ask her a tough question. And they just put me through the ringer. I mean, it was so unfair. And, you know, I'd go on television shows. And I remember once going on, you know, the local NPR station to do a debate. And, of course, they had two pro-abortion people and me. So it was always me against two people. And then, you know, mm-hmm. other interviews where I'd be thinking I was going on alone and I walk in and I'd been set up to do a debate, which I don't mind. I don't mind doing a debate. But it was always like the pro-lifer was there just to sort of be the punching bag and be the vehicle by which the pro-choice person could, you know. And anytime we could come out and have an effective argument or have a good comeback, you know, they would hate it. They would get so angry. But, you know, and they always had, of course, so much money. You know, this is the other thing that the pro-life movement has never quite had the funds that the abortion movement has had, right? I mean, I remember one time I was going to Washington to do some talks and was with a friend and we were looking over Catholics for Free Choice, their budget, because they had just released their annual budget. And we saw that Frances Kissling had a $70,000 a year clothing budget that was part of her, you know. And here we are, you know, I was at the Archdiocese. I was barely paying off my school loans, living in a, you know, a studio apartment and, you know, shopping at Goodwill for my suits because, you know, back in the 80s, everybody wore suits to everything. So, and of course, the abortion industry is big money, right? It's a half a billion dollar a year industry. So, you know, they had plenty of funding from the clinics and everything else. So I always felt like we had to make something out of nothing. And when you consider, you know, that we've always been a woman and mom-based grassroots, you know, movement. But like you say, a lot of division, right, early in the movement, in a way, kind of like the civil rights movement, right?
Absolutely.
You had the Martin Luther Kings, but then you also had the people, you had the Malcolm X's.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it's a big movement. You know, there were the activists that really wanted to kind of take the bull by the horns, and then there were the incrementalists who said, no, we got to work through the legal system. We got to be, you know, careful the way we do this. But, you know, any social movement's going to have those different factions.
It is indeed. Where we're going, I think, I really do think we've made tremendous inroads in telling the public about the beauty and sanctity of unborn life,
mm-hmm.
and in showing our care for mothers. Not that we can't do more. We must do more.
Right.
But I see the other end. I see the assisted suicide, the euthanasia movement moving into a culture that... is in many ways a feel-good culture, you
right.
know? Marriage, it's okay because two people love one another, so then that's okay. Well, if somebody wants to have their life ended, that's okay. I see the assisted suicide movement or the euthanasia movement really ramping up. And they're doing it just exactly like they did for Roe.
Yeah.
They're going state by state. They're softening the public. They've changed from the Hemlock organization to Compassion and Choices.
Right.
They framed it as a choice, which is what Americans love, apple pie and motherhood and choice, you know?
Right.
I see that movement. State by state, they'll wait to get a great case, and
right.
they'll take it up to the court.
And unfortunately, you know, when we talk about the right to die, you know, for the working poor in particular, it becomes the duty to die, right?
It's
people who see their family, you know, struggling financially because of their illness, and they think, you know what? Gosh, the state has this, quote, option now for me. Maybe I have an obligation now.
Yes.
Because I am such a financial drain on my family. Whereas the law would always protect people like that, right? And again, this is not to in any way diminish the suffering that many families have to feel. But, you know, there is a value in that life, whether it's old or sick, whether it's young and, you know, and unborn, that really undergirds how we feel about all of these issues, right? And I'm glad to hear you to tie that in. And that's something Lake County Right to Life often will legislate on too, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
Advocate about, yeah.
You know, I think, Mary, of the, this is the anniversary of 9/11. And I think of all those firefighters in New York.
Yeah.
All of them who knew when they walked in that building that they would not come out.
Right.
I mean, but they walked in that building carrying 40 to 60 pounds of equipment, walking up, 40, 50 flights of stairs. And they did it because they loved what they were doing and they loved other people.
Mm-hmm.
And
People they didn't know.
They were dedicated to their role of firefighting. And I think I liken the pro-life movement to that. You know, we put on our gear, whether it's our suit to go debate or whether it's our slacks to go pray peacefully, or we come and become more educated. We are like those firefighters.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who we're saving.
Right. Well, Bonnie Quirk, thank you for everything you have done. I know when you go to meet the Lord, there's going to be a lot of babies you're going to meet that you had a role in saving. So this has been Mary Fiorito. I've been sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed.